Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Shabbat shalom, everyone. Shabbat shalom. As Rabbi Nathan mentioned, we are talking about the Mishkan, and that is the temporary tent that we carried with us through the wilderness. And then, of course, during the time of Solomon, the first temple was built, the Solomonic Temple, and later on, two other times, the temple was either refurbished or completely rebuilt. So I'd like to share some lessons from the architecture of the temple. See, architecture says a lot about how people think of themselves and their purpose in this world and what they hope for. I'll give you an example. Ever see the buildings of Boston College? Austere, solid. And I would like to suggest to you that there's a theological backdrop to the way the architecture of Boston College turned out. And that is the sense that the Catholic community has existed for centuries and centuries and is going to continue for centuries and centuries more. And so that architecture suggests grandeur and permanence. You see? Now, by strong contrast, I would like to talk with you about the architecture of Ruach Israel's first meeting place. Happened to be in Brookline, 1200 Beacon Street, at the Travel Lodge Hotel. Now it's owned by another company, and everything has radically changed. But back then, you walk down a few stairs, and what do you encounter? A little room with carpeted walls and two pillars obstructing your view if you sat anywhere back. You know what I mean? Let's just say that the reputation of the hotel was not like that of a Disney hotel. Do I have to be more explicit? You know what I mean? Do I have to be clear on that point? And so the architecture, the message of the architecture, not intentionally, but what came across was, we didn't build this place with synagogues in mind. Okay? I mean, it's the architecture. Now, let's think about the architecture of our facility here. Okay? So if we were to look at our sanctuary, it has high ceilings. Well, what does that suggest? It suggests our emphasis on the transcendence and glory of God. You see, it's communicated subtly but powerfully. That's what high ceilings do. Low ceilings have a very different setting. If you were to look at the building from the outside when you came in today, you will notice that it looks like a New England house. And that was by design. We built it that way because there was a kind of meta-communication, if you will, and that was that we did not want to seem like some odd group coming in, damaging the sense of the neighborhood, but rather we're friendly to the neighborhood and wanted to look in a way that would be comfortable to the people already living here. You see, architecture says a lot about what you think about yourself and how you're seeking to project yourself into the world about you. Now, let's think about something else. It's not architecture as such, but if the transcendence of God and his bigness and his being beyond everything is suggested by a high ceiling, by contrast, what do you think comfy seating suggests? What do you think? Very comfortable chairs, right? What might it suggest?
Goodness.
Goodness, certainly, but what else? What else?
Casual.
Casual. Accessible. God is lofty and transcendent, but there's a certain accessibility to him suggested by the furnishings. Are you getting the picture here? Okay. So we can go on with this. Normally, we have the reading table, the amud, on the bema, on the raised section there. And that I want to suggest, again, because there's a little bit of distance, suggests something very important, the transcendence of God. He's not just my buddy in heaven. He is the king. And we approach him with a certain reverence and care, and the physical distance suggests that. Very holy thing. But sometimes when we bring the furnishings down, we do that on Yom Kippur for the evening service, and we do during our a cappella services. So if the distance is suggested, if the furnishings at a distance suggest his grandeur and the fact that he's not just my buddy who I've got in my back pocket to do what I want to do, I'm being overexpressing that, but you get the idea. What does the closeness of the furnishing suggest by contrast? Again, what? His. How about the word accessibility? And that we're all into this together. And that the clergy and you all together are, can be in close proximity. And you see, you've got to have both. If you lose either of these, you really lose out big time. So we're talking about furnishings, and we can talk about Cheryl's beautiful tapestries and what they suggest. And we're going to talk more about that in the months ahead. But they suggest a certain aesthetic sense that God loves beauty, that beautiful things reflect his glory, you see? And that a certain nod, if you will, to the to certain cultural realities, that, that there's a certain abstractness which is desirable and good too. You don't have to state everything. You can suggest things. Okay, all of that just to make a point that architecture says a lot about us and can communicate a lot about God. Now we're going to talk about a particular aspect of the architecture, not of the Mishkan, but of Solomon's temple. And there's so much we can talk about, but I just want to talk about a couple of things. One, a little bit, and one I want to emphasize. One very interesting thing about, actually it was true of the Mishkan as well as his temple, is that the inner room, the most inner room, where God meets the Kohen Gadol once a year at Yom Kippur, the high priest, is a perfect cube. What, and this is not the easiest question, what might the place where God and man meet, God and humankind meet, what might be suggested by a perfect cube? What's suggested by that is that the Mishkan, and particularly the inner sanctum, the Kodesh Kodeshim, suggests the ideal world where God and people would be together without all of the tsuris, the trouble that we experience now. You see, that's the message. It's an idealized universe. It's the perfect universe with all of the dimensions exactly equal, and these things are suggested by the Mishkan. But let me go on from that to one particular thing, and there's a comment in the Talmud which the rabbis who understood the tradition of what the temple actually looked like, you know, so they had some accurate information about these things. And it says in our Haftorah portion, we didn't read the whole thing, but in a section of the Haftorah, we read this. He, that is Solomon, made narrow windows high up in the temple walls. And on the basis of that verse, these narrow windows, which are high up, the height was roughly 30 feet, again, emphasizing that, that transcendent aspect. And it says, in the Talmud, it says, he made for the house windows broad on the outside and narrow on the inside. Now, what does that mean? Imagine a thin wall. Our windows may be like these in the back, approximated, but these were beveled in such a way that they were narrow on the inside, but if you were to go around the building to the outside, you would see that they would be more open. And the question is, why would they have built the Mishkan this way? And there is a famous rabbi that suggests, and this is Vayikra Rabba, the comment in the Midrash. Rabbi Chanina said, the temple possessed windows, and from them its light would go out to to the world. They were narrow on the inside and wide on the outside in order to bring light into the world. Now think about this. What is the meaning of this? We would normally expect that if God wanted to shed lots of light on the inside, then the windows would be narrower on the outside, but wider on the inside, so that the light could be diffused more among the whole space of the Mishkan. Isn't that what we would expect? But it's the opposite. Instead of the intention being that the space would be lit up, rather, the intention is that the light would be expressed outwardly to the world. That is, again, I'll use the big word metacommunication, or the intention, according to Rabbi Chanina, that the light would be more on the outside than on the inside. And there's lots of applications. We could think of it this way. God didn't need the light on the inside. He didn't need it. He didn't need a brightly lit office. That wasn't the purpose. The purpose of the Mishkan is to shed light to the world. It's a testimony to God's totality, His greatness, His wonder, His aesthetic sense, His love for people, His meeting with us, the need for atonement, another whole sermon. All of that is suggested by the Mishkan. But the light, the emphasis is not the light coming in, but the light going out. And I can't help but think of Yeshua's words, "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on the stand, and it gives the light to everyone in the house." The light extending outward. I'd like to talk with you next a little bit about the vocation or the purpose of a Messianic Jewish synagogue in this connection as it relates to this lesson from the Mishkan. Again, I just want to repeat it. There were windows, vertical windows. They were high up according to the Haftorah passage. And the light went outward. It wasn't to enlighten the space so much as it was to suggest that the light is an outwardly expressed light. Are you all with me on that? You get that picture? Okay. Now let's talk about this. I'd like to share with you two wrong conceptions of what not just we, but the Messianic Jewish enterprise, because it's important you understand this. Many of you have cast your lot with this synagogue and with this unique expression, Jewish expression, and I want you to have an accurate picture of things. And so let me share with you, by contrast, two not wrong, but I will call them incomplete conceptions. And the first is this. As a kind of Judaism, our primary goal, and in some people's minds exclusive goal, is to be inwardly focused, as opposed to the church, which is supposed to be to the world. And this view was concretized most powerfully and most convincingly in 1919 with a famous book by one of the great Jewish thinkers of all times, Franz Rosenzweig, who wrote a book called The Star of Redemption. And it's a very dense and difficult book, originally written in German. It's been translated into English, and at MJTI you'll have to learn a little bit about this book. But the essential message is that Franz Rosenzweig had a tremendous desire to see how the church and the Jewish people interrelated in a redemptive way. But his model, I'd like to suggest, is very good in some respects, but for us a bit incomplete. And here's the model. The star of redemption, the star is like our sun, a gaseous cloud where constant atomic activity is causing tremendous amounts of heat and, of course, light. And in his model, the Jewish people are like the sun in that it constantly renews itself through this fission, this nuclear reaction, but its goal is to sustain itself, whereas the church, the worldwide community who believes in Yeshua and Jesus, that is like the rays of the sun that extend to the extremities of the solar system and bring light. And in some ways, the model has something really going for it, but I'd like to suggest that from a Messianic Jewish standpoint, it's incomplete in the sense that through the modeling of Yeshua and his teaching to us, and based on teachings of Isaiah, which I don't have time to get into, that the Messianic Jewish enterprise is not only interior focused, but rather is to have an element of exterior focus, that we have the message of the Messiah, particularly to share with our own people. You have missionaries from all groups showing to the various nations of the world, but our unique vocation is to our own people, but as going out, not just concerned with what's happening within the walls, but exterior, outward as well. And so I think that the Star of Redemption and this concept is good insofar as it goes, but it is incomplete. However, there is a counterbalancing mistake on the other side of the equation, which tends to view the Messianic Jewish enterprise as largely, if not almost entirely, an external thing. And I would call this the Jewish missions model, if you will. And I say this in the most friendly way. We have lots of friends in that world and much to learn from those good folks. But I think that there is a fundamental mistake on that side of the equation, where Messianic Jewish synagogues are looked at as a kind of mission station to make it easy for Jewish people to embrace Yeshua because of a certain cultural resonance. But there's nothing intrinsic to the Messianic Jewish enterprise that should see the Israel sustaining work, the door-to-door focus, the emphasis on mitzvot as obligation, not just cultural affinity. There is a missing element in that equation. And again, I say it in a friendly way, but it is true. The motivation is, if you want to reach the Eskimos, be like an Eskimo. If you want to go to this group, then look like them. But that would be a terribly superficial understanding of what we do here. Horribly superficial. Because we believe in this internal relationship between God and Israel, as in this covenant relationship made at Sinai. There are things internal to us that are critically important that may not have a whole lot of relevance out there, but for us, they are like the sun sustaining itself. And so the mitzvot and the standards, the halakhic standards we have, which make sure that there are distinctions between Israel and the nations, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to get real specific and abstract. It's not a seminar, it's a sermon. But nonetheless, I want to say that I think that the model, that mission model, is admirable in one sense, but incomplete, and I'll have to say, for me, I found it to be, in a way, disingenuous, because I felt that I couldn't put on a yarmulke and tallit and do all these things if it's largely for the purpose of evangelism. No, it has to come from the sun rejuvenating itself, the sun, S-U-N, Allah, the Star of Redemption. It has to come from my obligation to be a Jew, because this is what God has made me to be by covenant, not just by cultural proclivity. Am I being clear, or am I completely missing you guys?
A little of both.
Well, at Oneg we can straighten it out. But it's really, really quite important, so I'll ask you to think about it. Let me just close by saying this. Yeshua shared with us the parable of the sower. And the idea is the soil, okay? For the past 35 years, we've been around and we have sought to be that good soil that seeks to hold on to both sides of the equation, the external looking aspect and also the internal rejuvenation of what we're all about as a people. And it's an exciting journey. It's a fabulous journey, and I would just ask you to join with me in prayer that these next 35 years, we would be able to not only continue with a proper inward focus, sustaining our people because God made a covenant with us, but also an external focus to our people who are outside of Messiah completely. And I'm thrilled to see City Ruach, and we're going to have the Ruach House, God willing, where some of our Jewish young people will be living and sharing the good news outside of our four walls. That's the point I'm trying to make. So let's be praying that these next 35 years would be so fantastic that God would smile and that we would just so enjoy what He's doing among us. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Know your name and study your Torah for Messiah's sake. For Messiah's